Our top story this week, progress in Miami. The Department of Homeland Security downgrades Miami's threat status as local defenders claim victory in an offensive that brought liberation to large parts of the city. And federal aircraft arrive at Miami International Airport, bringing supplies for the city's intrepid defenders. But as Miami's defense forces continue their push to retake reanimate-held territory, their efforts received a setback this week as a terrorist attack in one of the city's marinas destroyed a number of private vessels involved in the sea lift and caused damage to the dock facilities. Our war correspondent Kate Malik is in Miami and will bring us all the details. The search continues for the missing cargo ship Autumn Dawn. The fate of the 1,500-foot vessel filled with agricultural products bound for China remains a mystery, but officials believe its crew has been completely overwhelmed by infection. Chinese officials had hoped it would remain on course, which would have seen it appear off the coast of Taiwan this week, but no such sightings have been made, prompting the Chinese government to make urgent appeals to Washington. Congress approves emergency funding for NASA to move forward with a mission to colonize Mars. In a move deemed popular with the American public, the Space Administration received the funding it needed to begin the process of sending Americans to permanently inhabit the Red Planet and ensure the survival of the human species. But the mission, which comes years ahead of earlier projections, is not without substantial risk. And at this week's RLA discussion table, we will be joined by a panel of experts who will help us better understand the domestic terror group, the Legion for the Return of the Lamb. Who are they? What are they trying to accomplish? And how big a threat do they pose in these already difficult times? You're listening to Radio Living America, and I'm your host, Brian Andrews. Our first story has us returning to Miami, Florida, where local forces scored a big victory this week in an offensive that linked three of the city's largest living strongholds and connected them with the defensive beachhead, creating a newly established reanimate-free zone that stretches from Biscayne Bay deep into Miami-Dade County. With the success of the operation liberating so much of Miami, the Department of Homeland Security took the measure to downgrade Miami's threat status from dead city to stage 4 contaminated, marking the first time a city has had its status changed after being declared dead. But as defenders continue their push, their efforts were impaired midweek when a terrorist attack interrupted resupply efforts. For more on the story, we go to our battlefield correspondent, Kate Malik, who is on location.
The defenders of Miami have paused their posture and are regrouping following the operations earlier in the week. The offensive was originally intended to bridge the 2 miles that separated the living stronghold at the Jackson Memorial Hospital complex with the Miami defensive beachhead. However, by the end of the operation, defenders had retaken nearly 50 square miles of the city. Casualties from the offensive were less than planners had anticipated. And while Miami's local defense forces did have momentum to continue deeper into the county, the sheer volume of reanimate casualties forced the operation to halt to give combatants a chance to process the dead and consolidate their gains. While there is no word on federal troops coming into Miami, cargo planes from Fort Benning did begin flights to Miami International Airport this week after the Department of Homeland Security reclassified Miami back to a living city. The transports have been bringing everything from food, medical supplies, ammunition, and importantly, gasoline and diesel fuel. The mayor traveled by boat this morning across the Bay of Biscayne to give a press conference at his former headquarters, located at the Miami Beach Golf Club. In a question and answer session with reporters, he said this.
I'm happy, really happy to report that offensive operations begun earlier this week have resulted in over 50 square miles of Miami being liberated by our local defense forces. Before the operation, we were in control of a beachhead that only extended 8 or 10 blocks from the Bay of Biscayne. But now, we are in control of an area that extends west to Florida Highway 826 and south to Florida Highway 986. This area includes the living strongholds located at the Jackson Memorial Hospital Complex, Miami International Airport, and the University of Miami, amongst others, and has resulted in liberating hundreds of thousands of Miamians. Furthermore, from this more pronounced area of operation, we are better positioned to conduct resupply missions to the living strongholds at the Walmart Supercenter in Gladeview, the Miami International Mall in Sweetwater, and the Miami Zoo. I'll take questions.
Mayor Vasquez, what are your...
Yes, over here.
Thank you, and congratulations on your victory. It seems like you overshot your objectives early in the day and were very comfortable continuing west, but then you suddenly made the decision to stop. Did resistance suddenly get stiffer as you headed deeper into the county? What caused the sudden stop?
It was the sheer number of reanimate casualties that caused us to halt the offensive. By the end of the first day, there were hundreds of thousands of enemy corpses all over the streets of Miami. This represents a major health concern. We can't just have them out in the open, baking in South Florida's subtropical sun. To that end, we have dug mass burial sites at the golf courses at the Palm Front Country Club, the Westmore Country Club, and at the public park in Coral Terrace. When we have that resolved, we will consider moving further.
Mayor Vasquez, what are you...
I can't say no to Kate Malik. She's the only one of you guys who had the guts to go across the bay and cover this thing. Nice to see you, Kate.
Thank you, Mayor. What role did the force from Naples play, and how was that coordinated?
I've been in contact with the mayor of Naples since the beginning of this crisis, when we still believed the army was sending a task force. Before we got the news that we were on our own, we had thought we might evacuate some of our refugees to Naples. As we were planning this offensive, I reached back out to the leadership of Naples and asked if they could provide a diversionary force to the west to try to draw the enemy off while we moved inland. When word got around the Gulf Coast that we were getting ready to go on the offensive, the city governments of Fort Myers and Tampa both offered to send us troops as well.
And what was the impact of those reinforcements?
Well, having those guys to our west, making a lot of noise, definitely confused the enemy and made it easier for us to take them on. The reanimates never achieved critical mass in numbers because they just had too many things pulling for their attention.
Mayor Vasquez, what are you...
Yes, over here.
The federal government has begun resupply missions via Miami International Airport. Do you take that as an indication a military task force could be on its way?
I have made it clear to the governor of Florida, and I am sure he has communicated this to Washington, that we still require all the federal assistance we can get. But at this time, we've received no indication that federal troops are outbound for Miami.
While the mayor may indicate that he has no information about a task force assigned to Miami, rumors spread like wildfire in recent days that, in fact, aircraft were assembling at Fort Benning and that Army units there are preparing to be deployed. While the White House has been completely silent since the Miami offensive, the Pentagon has not, with Joint Chiefs Chairman William Abibio releasing a statement saying, "We congratulate the defenders of Miami in their recent operations.
Your victory represents true heroism and brilliant tactical thinking. In the future, when Americans learn about the sacrifices at Miami, they will be taught alongside Bunker Hill, the Alamo, and Bastogne. We are all watching your brave efforts, and the federal military looks forward to joining the fight."
But even with a feeling of victory in the air, Miami's defenders were met with a setback earlier in the week as boats involved in the sea lift became victim of a terrorist attack. The 42-foot sailing vessel Aquaholic, hailing from Baltimore, Maryland, had been reported stolen 2 weeks ago.
Okay, this is it. You can do this, Gary. You can do this. Miami Harbor Master, this is the sailing vessel Aquaholic, inbound from Baltimore with cargo for the sea lift. I'm just crossing the jetty now. Over.
Copy that, Aquaholic. Directly in front of you, you should see a 60-foot Beneteau sailboat turning left down the fairway. You'll be turning down the next dock on the left. That's E dock. You're assigned slip E26. I repeat, that's Echo 26. I'm going to need your Maryland registration number or federal documentation number. Over.
I've got my Fed dock number if you're ready.
We're ready on this end. Go ahead, Aquaholic.
It's 992 494. Over.
Just to confirm, Aquaholic, that was 992494. Correct. Over.
That's correct.
Aquaholic, this is Captain Menocal of the Miami Self-Defense Force. Reverse course immediately. Exit the Marine Basin and sail northeast to the 12 buoy, where you will be met by a patrol vessel and boarded.
Okay.
Aquaholic, if you do not comply and reverse course, we will open fire on you.
The righteous will bask in God's glory. The righteous will bask in... The unrighteous will be damned, and the righteous will bask in God's glory!
The sailboat detonated an explosive device that destroyed the vessel, along with four other relief vessels and 40 feet of dock space. Officials are treating this as an act of domestic terrorism by the Legion for the Return of the Lamb and are asking anyone with information related to this case to come forward and contact their local law enforcement. Reporting from the front, Miami, Florida, I'm Kate Malik. Back to you, Brian.
Kate Malik, thank you. Chinese officials made an urgent appeal to Washington this week for accelerated shipments of agricultural products in the wake of the disappearance of the cargo ship Autumn Dawn. The ship, which was scheduled to arrive in the port of Shanghai with its cargo of rice, corn, and soybeans earlier this week, is presumed to have sailed into a Category 2 typhoon following an outbreak of the reanimate pandemic that claimed the crew southwest of Hawaii. For more on this developing story, we go to our Washington correspondent, Chuck Fleming.
Chinese officials, led by Ambassador Li Weizheng, have been conducting tireless meetings with members of the State Department and members of the Office of the United States Trade Representative at the Harry S. Truman Building here in Washington, D.C. While the meetings have been closed door, there can be little doubt that the subject is the missing cargo ship and the possibilities for an accelerated export schedule from the United States to help alleviate an already tenuous situation in China. Sources tell us that Chinese negotiators were pushing hard for the United States to advance another ship or ships as quickly as possible. However, experts warn that the United States isn't in the position to replace a ship like the Autumn Dawn in a time frame that would suit the Chinese government, at least not without redirecting ships already at sea destined for other countries.
Chuck, technically, who owns the Autumn Dawn and its cargo?
Well, Brian, that's where things get a little stickier. The Autumn Dawn is a U.S.-domiciled vessel and is owned by an American import-export company. The cargo became the property of the Chinese government once it was loaded onto the ship in New Orleans. Now, that cargo was insured, and with food commodity prices having jumped eightfold since the outbreak, that would value the cargo at nearly $2 billion. But the Chinese officials seem little interested in financial compensation. Sources within the State Department have indicated that if the United States were to reroute other cargo ships with agricultural export, the Chinese would be willing to pay three times the market rate in gold bullion, six times the market rate in rare earth elements, or forgive a staggering $30 billion of U.S. Treasury debt issued before the pandemic that was purchased by the Chinese government.
But if the cargo is owned by the importer once it's loaded onto the ship, how could the United States reroute vessels already at sea?
It would require the United States to exercise an interpretation of eminent domain that clearly makes the U.S. government uneasy. Speaking today at a press conference following meetings with the Chinese diplomatic garrison, Anders Parker, director of the Office of the United States Trade Representative, said this.
Thank you all for being here. We've been working hard over the last handful of days to try to compensate for the situation that has developed around the missing cargo ship. First, let me just say, an active search continues for this vessel, and it's our belief that it will be recovered. But in the absence of that, we cannot, in good faith, redirect other ships at this time. We will continue to work closely with the Chinese government, and we will give priority to China for future exports. But the ships that are currently at sea will remain on course for their intended destinations.
To help give us better understanding of what these negotiations really mean, we sat down with Dr. Feng Huang, senior fellow at the China Policy Institute, to ask her thoughts on the negotiations.
I'm not surprised to see the Chinese government make an appeal to the United States offering a premium if the missing cargo could be replaced. But I am surprised by the extremes to which the government was willing to go. I would imagine that China, in making these proposals, was fully expecting a counteroffer from the United States. And I would be very, very interested to know what China's officials had determined internally was the threshold in negotiations. If the U.S. had requested that the $60 billion of Treasury debt be forgiven instead of $30 billion, would China have accepted that? What if the United States said it would redirect ships headed to Europe for $100 billion?
Dr. Huang, what do you think the situation is in China at this moment?
I would have to believe it's very desperate. You have to remember, China has always maintained a large standing army. They started to reduce their manpower towards the end of the 20th century. But even at the pandemic outbreak, they had over 1.5 million personnel in uniform. Unlike the United States, which went on a program to decentralize its military in response to the pandemic, China maintained a very centralized military structure. And now, we believe the ranks of the People's Liberation Army may have swelled to as many as 4 million in response to the disease.
And why is that important in our discussion of the missing cargo ship? What do you see the implications being?
I believe the food shortages in China have left the government with a very tenuous grip on power. The expanded military is a natural response to the crisis, but to keep it so centralized is not just a byproduct of communist doctrine. I believe it is a way for the government to maintain control of a population made restless with hunger and skyrocketing unemployment. I think this recent offer by the government of China reflects a palpable sense of urgency.
Ryan, one thing was certain from our conversation with Dr. Huang. The Chinese government is in dire need of agricultural resupply from the United States. Given that China had the world's largest pre-pandemic population, officials within the State Department and the Pentagon are concerned that if the Chinese military became compromised and a wildfire outbreak was allowed to go uncontested as it did in Japan, the end result could be over 1 billion new reanimates. Back to you, Brian.
Chuck Fleming in Washington, D.C. Thank you. When we return, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration unveils a bold plan to colonize the planet Mars.
Tired of eating kale and tilapia out of your pandemic garden? New government ration limits leaving you and your family bored and hungry with what you can get at the store? Well, come on down to Vince's Barbecue and enjoy some of our mouth-watering pea protein isolate brisket. We always use real coal-stoked wood for a flavorful, juicy product. Or enjoy some of our big beef-like ribs, an expeller-pressed canola oil sausage sampler, or smoked turkey made with real bamboo cellulose. All our products are 100% plant-based meat substitutes that aren't managed on the federal ration list, allowing us to bring you the exceptional value of an entree and two sides for only $9.99. Stop by our butcher shop and pick something up for your next cookout. Or let us cater your next corporate event, birthday, or wedding. Come by and see if you can taste the difference. Family owned and operated. Stop by a Vincent's Barbecue near you.
Vincent's Barbecue, smoking our way through the pandemic.
Once reserved for the pages of science fiction, a mission to Mars, much less the colonization of the planet, seemed years away. But with the pandemic raising questions about humanity's viability on Earth, a pioneering mission has received funding, and officials unveiled plans to colonize one of Earth's nearest neighbors. In a move that reflected strong bipartisan support, the House of Representatives voted 401 to 34 on a measure to provide NASA with a staggering $1 trillion of emergency funding to expedite the mission. For more on the story, we take you to RLA's Laura Sanders.
Brian, I'm here at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, NASA's historic launch center, which now also serves as mission control following the loss of Houston. It was here today that officials unveiled plans to send 100 Americans on a journey to permanently colonize Mars. Prior to the reanimating pandemic, NASA officials had referred to a Mars mission timeline in decades, but with the reanimates threatening humankind with extinction, they're no longer talking in terms of decades, but rather in terms of months. Speaking at a press conference here today at the Space Center, NASA's Chief Administrator Thomas Sullivan had this to say.
Thank you all for being here. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration is pleased to report that we are moving aggressively forward to colonize the planet Mars. NASA has been planning a Mars mission for decades, but today we are announcing a concrete plan to not just go to Mars, but to actually establish a permanent colony that can operate independent of support from Earth. With this mission, for the first time, humankind will inhabit not just one, but two planets. With the pandemic threatening our humankind's viability on our home planet, this mission will ensure that our species endures. I am pleased to be joined by Peter Alexopoulos, Chief Scientist at NASA, who will brief you on the mission specifics.
Thank you, Tom. The challenges of establishing a permanent settlement on Mars are daunting, to say the least. It's a low-pressure environment with almost no oxygen, little water, high levels of solar radiation, a toxic atmosphere, and even more toxic soil profile. It can experience temperature swings of over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in a single day, and Mars routinely experiences dust storms that can engulf the entire planet and last for weeks. However, we believe we have a plan that will allow us to put a permanent facility on Mars. In planning our mission, our initial concerns are providing the pilgrims with a source of water that can be harvested from Mars itself, protecting them from the intense solar radiation found at the surface of Mars, and providing them with oxygen, which only exists in trace amounts in the Martian atmosphere. Based on our findings from the 2020 Mars rover missions, we have strong reasons to believe that there is subsurface ice in much of the southern hemisphere of Mars. And our plan is to deploy a mission to the dormant volcano complex Hadriacus Mons, where the settlers can establish a protected base camp in caves that had once served as lava tubes for the volcano. Once the settlers have established their frontier outpost, they will then begin work at the neighboring crater of Hellas Planitia to establish a subterranean facility that will serve as their permanent home. We're hoping to begin launches of equipment and remotely operated vehicles on our new magnetoplasma rockets in as little as 6 months, with crew launches on traditional liquid fuel rockets in about 18 months. We're naming the mission Artemis, twin sister to Apollo. Because we've been testing these rocket technologies for Mars since before the pandemic, the first equipment launch will be Artemis 4, and we anticipate the first Pioneer mission will be Artemis 9.
Brian, the science director would go on to explain that the ultimate goal would be for the Mars pioneers to dig a subterranean colony deep enough below the Hellas Planitia crater that they could live in an environment of ambient pressure. That would require them to dig nearly 4.5 miles below the crater floor. Despite the enormous price tag, funding for the project received an overwhelming level of support from the House of Representatives following this appeal by Congressman Neil Baskin of Wisconsin.
Amendment 25, printed in House Report 86-15C, offered by Mr. Baskin of Wisconsin.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Wisconsin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Is there a member of this House so selfish, so self-consumed that they would put their interests or the interests of their district above the survival of the human race? We are faced with a crisis that threatens our very existence. Everything we are, everything we have ever been, and everything we could ever be is at risk of being lost. No cost is too great to ensure our survival. I ask my colleagues in the House to vote with me to fund the NASA colonization of Mars and ensure that whatever happens here on Earth, our species and all our greatness will continue on and prevail.
Now, both government and NASA officials wish to stress that this is a logical evolution of the space program. And while it's being accelerated because of the pandemic, it in no way represents a belief that the pandemic war is unwinnable. Reporting from Cape Canaveral, Florida, I'm Laura Sanders. Back to you, Brian.
When we return, we'll have this week's edition of the RLA Discussion Table, where I'll be joined by a panel of experts to help us better understand the Legion for the Return of the Lamb, its motives, and its elusive, shadowy leader.
Phew. This is my last M249 squad automatic weapon I have to clean, and my shift at the armory is over.
I hear you. I've got one more M203 grenade launcher, and I'm right behind you. I want to do my part, but these cleaning oils are hell on my skin. I'm 45. Now I have wrinkles and acne.
Tell me about it, Lisa. My skin is so dry and flaky, I worry someone might mistake me for a reanimate.
I hate to complain during the pandemic, but I really miss my organic skincare products.
I hear you. What I would give for a facial right now.
Did I hear someone say organic skincare?
Who are you?
I'm Rex from Granite State Tactical.
Aren't you the guy that sells the bug out bags?
Is there another? I'm here to help you get your pre-pandemic glow back with Granite State Tactical's Beauty Defense.
Beauty Defense? We're listening.
Create your own personalized organic skincare products with a Beauty Defense Kit. The kit includes a mini hydroponic system to quickly grow complexion-caring herbs. Choose from hundreds of herbs like anti-aging chamomile and calendula to decrease inflammation. Revive dull skin with holy basil. Reduce those pesky blemishes with lavender. And it smells great too. Beauty Defense comes with everything you need to create your own serums and facial treatments, including almond oil and aloe vera from the Central Valley of California. But don't take my word for it. Listen to what satisfied customer Sergeant Kathy Nowak of the Army's 1st Battalion, 73rd Cavalry Regiment had to say.
I may spend all my time neutralizing reanimates with the same three idiots from the 1st Battalion.
Swing and a miss. Will you shut the fuck up?
But that doesn't mean I stopped caring about my skin. With serums and balms that are quick to grow, easy to use, and transportable in most rucksacks and bug-out bags, Granite State Tactical's self-reliant skincare systems keep my skin looking its best, even on the pandemic front line.
Ladies, I think that about sums it up. Now you can defend your community and your skin with GST's Beauty Defense.
Thanks, Rex.
We're going to order our kits today.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to be joined at this week's roundtable by Melissa Lawrence, analyst with the Washington-based think tank Center for Strategic Security Assessment, Peter Mueller, professor of philosophy and religion at Princeton University, and Chris Rall, senior fellow at the New York Institute for Clinical Psychology. Thank you all for being here. Melissa, I'd like to begin with you. How dangerous is the Legion for the Return of the Lamb? And why has law enforcement been so ineffective with dealing with this group? In just today's episode, we reported on their most recent attack in the Miami operation. But it seems many, many incidents for the last year, whether claimed or unclaimed, are being attributed to the group.
This group is dangerous in that they seem capable of appearing anytime, anywhere. However, to date, the attacks have all been on a small scale, comprised of random bombings or other small-scale acts of violence directed towards efforts to fight the pandemic.
Why do you think they haven't attempted a bigger attack?
I think it's a combination of things. First, this is a group that has been impossible to bring out of the shadows, and I'm sure they want to keep it that way. But also, it's very new, and I think they are probably operating at the leading edge of their abilities. There's a big risk here that they recruit someone from, say, within the military or a high-ranking member of a local defense force and carry out a much larger attack.
Chris, who do you suspect these people are, And why are they attracted to this movement?
Well, I think these people are classic followers of a doomsday cult. Typically, people become involved in these movements because they've failed to find meaning in mainstream society. The movement gives them the purpose they'd been seeking, and their new commonly held belief in catastrophe emboldens the followers with a sense of uniqueness and purpose.
But in the few cases where a member could be identified following a suicide attack, the people involved seemed very nondescript, like everyday Americans.
I said these people failed to find meaning in mainstream society. I never said they were on the fringe of society. Anyone from any part of society can have feelings of emptiness that make them vulnerable. And to Melissa's point, it is absolutely conceivable that someone from a position of real power could be hypnotized by this movement and lead an operation of a much bigger scale than what we've seen so far.
Professor Mueller, help our listeners understand what this cult, as Chris has described it, what this cult stands for. What exactly are they trying to accomplish?
Well, let me attempt to explain what's going on in their minds as I understand it. Clearly, they have identified the reanimate pandemic as the apocalypse, as described in the Book of Revelations in the New Testament. Their leader refers to himself as John of the Apocalypse, an obvious reference to John the Apostle, and he makes continuous reference to seals being broken to allow for the second coming of Christ. This is all directly from the New Testament.
Many people have conjectured about the apocalypse and its comparability to the reanimate pandemic. Based on what we've heard, what do you think they see that motivates them?
Well, the reanimation of the victims, first and foremost, obviously. When the fourth seal of the apocalypse is broken, it releases the horseman that is death, who is written to ride a pale yellowish horse. If you've signed on to this belief system, it's not a big leap to assume the reanimates, with their cadaverous appearance, could be this horse, and they are carrying death. The breaking of the fifth seal involves martyrdom of the Christian faithful, and I think that's where the followers see themselves fitting in.
When the group's leader broadcasts to his followers that the seals have been broken out of order, what do you think that refers to?
Well, there's a total of seven seals. When the seventh is broken, the faithful are vindicated, the wicked are judged, and Christ returns. That is clearly the finish line for this group. This could be open to interpretation, but I believe he's referring to the sixth seal, which, in a modern interpretation, is broken by a man-made event that destroys the environment. I think they could be looking at something like the climate change or the rapid development of natural environments that happened before the pandemic as being evidence that the sixth seal has already been broken, which would leave us very close to Judgment Day in their world.
Melissa, why has this group been so hard to monitor? How much progress do you think law enforcement has had in determining who the members of this group are or who its leader is?
Part of the problem stems from the fact that the leader, John, is clearly residing somewhere in a dead zone, out of reach of law enforcement.
What makes you think that?
If you listen to the recordings that have been uploaded to the deep internet, occasionally you can hear a reanimating positioning beacon deploying in the background. I know military officials have tried to cycle the RAP-Bs in a way that would allow them to pinpoint which dead zone he's in, if they could get multiple RAP-B activations on one broadcast, but they've yet to get a recording that's reflected this. I suspect he edits his recordings before he somehow sends them outside his dead zone to be uploaded.
If I could just interject for a moment, Melissa brings up a really interesting observation.
Please, go ahead.
If the leader, John, is in a living stronghold behind reanimate lines, what are the conditions of that stronghold? It gives one serious reason to pause when we think of conditions for the living still trapped in these dead cities. We can't rule out that this person isn't just living in a living stronghold, but actually thriving as the leader of a doomsday cult in a living stronghold. I absolutely shudder to think what Jim Jones or David Koresh would have been able to establish so completely removed from society.
That brings me to my next question for you, Melissa. One could see how a rogue spiritual leader could deliver his message and control his followers from inside an area as contained as a living stronghold, completely isolated from normal society. But how does he spread his message and recruit in uninfected areas?
What you're touching on is the exact reason law enforcement has so much difficulty preempting their attacks. Once John of the Rapture gets one of his audios out of his dead zone, how that happens is another mystery, by the way, but once he gets it out and uploaded to the internet, to Professor Mueller's point, it resonates with some people, and they take it upon themselves to take action. It's absolutely identical to the kind of threats we saw in the 20-teens, when ISIS was using the internet to inspire followers in the West to take whatever violent action they were capable of.
Chris, what warning signs, if any, could our listeners look for to help them identify a potential cult member?
Well, I would certainly be suspicious of anyone who comes to the defense of John of the Rapture or the tactics of his followers. Any disassociative behavior, especially if it leads to a loss of interest in goals or personal relationships. People involved in cults often demonize people or groups that try to hold back the progress of the cult, so if someone you know becomes highly critical of government attempts to uncover the cult and curtail its activities, I would report them to your local defense force.
That was a fascinating discussion. Thank you all for your contribution. That concludes this week's episode. I'm Brian Andrews, asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and stay in the fight.